I'm Duncan MacLeod. This is TC Daily, the technology show brought to you by Tech Central. If you haven't subscribed, please do so. You can do that at youtube.com/TechCentral. Or why not subscribe to our daily newsletter as well? You can do that at techcentral.co.za/newsletter. Now, a question. Is it possible to deliver ultra-affordable fiber broadband uncapped into low-income communities in South Africa and to do so profitably? My next guest thinks it is. Steve Briggs. Very good to see you again. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Steve, last time I spoke to you, you were at Secom. You're now CEO of Seasware. Why the shift?
Right. So I had a great time at Secom. I was there for 5 years. I think what Secom taught me was, gave me a front row seat to the digitization on the continent, particularly the East African and Southern African markets where Secom's cable system operates. Also great exposure to, you know, B2B and enterprise, big digital assets like data centers and so on. So I think I've got a healthy appreciation for all the capacity and all the content that's streaming onto the continent.
Right, right.
The reason for the shift is a personal passion project of mine is to get more people onto the internet and having seen, in a sense, the supply side sorted out at a wholesale level. So lots of subsea cables landing, huge data centers being built, all the streaming services and OTT and everything else arriving, there's still a problem in terms of getting it to everyone. And I think COVID highlighted that in South Africa. You know, if you were in the leafy suburbs, life continued relatively unchanged if you needed to do your work or teach your kids or whatever it was. But outside of that bubble, you know, your world came to a hard stop. And I think it highlighted the two-tier economy between those who've got equitable access to the internet and those who don't. And, you know, by far the majority in South Africa are people who fall in the those who don't category.
The latter category, yeah.
So that's really the interest in the project.
Right. Yeah. So this name is Seasware. We know, I know the name Project is Seasware, which was an entity, a non-profit, I think, started by Alan, not Craig Jr. Is this in any way related to Project is Seasware?
It's related in as much as there's some common people who are involved. So Alan is very much involved. He's the chairman of is Seasware,
okay,
the for-profit. And I think what Project Seasware highlighted was if you can get low-cost internet into communities, they are willing buyers. I mean, it shouldn't surprise us, but they validated that. They even pioneered the 5 rand per day uncapped model. What Seasware is to take that and go and make it commercially profitable.
Okay. The focus has always been on Wi-Fi, though, previously.
Correct, yeah.
So
yeah.
Is Project Seasware itself also shifting its focus to fiber?
Project Seasware is very much as it's always been, finding communities often supported by big corporate sponsors where there is a need and then building out a Wi-Fi mesh network to those communities. So it really runs along a different set of principles to what Seasware is doing through PayGoZo and Vulacoin, which I'll unpacking this.
We'll get to now, but Project Seasware is a non-profit.
Correct.
Seasware is a for-profit.
Very much a for-profit.
Okay.
Yeah.
But and a lot of the same management team as a
Not even the same management team, just same individuals who have kind of been in the startup phase of it.
Understood.
Alan is no longer on the board at Project Seasware. I still am. I was a director there through the CSI component from Secom. But aside from that, there's no sharing of management teams or anything like that between the two entities.
Now, I remember before Vumatel and some of the other fiber upstarts started rolling out fiber around the country, telecommunications operators in South Africa, the big guys, said this is not feasible. I know that, I don't know if it was all of the mobile operators, but certainly some of them, and Telkom said, South Africans live too far apart, we can't roll out fiber, it's not going to make sense, maybe it'll work in Hong Kong or Singapore or somewhere like that, but we live relatively far apart in South Africa, this cannot be made to work. Along comes Vumatel, along comes a bunch of other fiber startups, and they proved them completely wrong. Now, you're saying that, you know, just 10 years ago, companies like Telkom were saying this is not feasible, but now you're saying not only is it feasible in the leafy suburbs, but you can take fiber to townships, you can take it to low-income areas, and you can still make a business out of it, which is an astonishing statement to make. Some people might think you're mad. You know, going into low-income townships. Do you think there really is a business case here for deploying uncapped high-speed internet into every corner of this country?
So we're in one giant laboratory test on that assumption right now.
Okay.
I think people are going to say we're mad. we've seen great results from a pilot project we're running in Kaimundi, which is in Stellenbosch. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can extrapolate this and say it's going to work for every corner of the country, but certainly metro areas where there's a high density, call them metropolitan townships,
right.
High density, high level of economic activity, we do believe there's a feasible solution there. And maybe, you know, just to go back to that, you know, before we rolled out into DP suburbs view, I recall those same debates where people said, you know, Hong Kong, high density of apartments, you could amortize your infrastructure over a great number of people. I mean, that's exactly what we're doing in townships now.
Right.
Just, you know.
It is high density.
It is high density. Right. And you know, just very simply, we've got, I think, roughly 16 million homes in South Africa. You know, if you have a broad definition of what a home is, from a shack to, you know, a big house in Westcliff, mm-hmm. We've fibered up, I think, about 3.2 million of those. At the, you know, last stats, if you look across all the big F&Os.
Which is an amazing achievement.
Which is amazing. And I mean, it's a relatively short time. I mean, I think, you know, call it 8 to 10 years, we've created a 50, 60 billion rand a year industry. And some people have done really well from building and starting and setting those businesses on. I think on average, we've got about a 25% penetration rate across those, call it 3.2 million homes. But that's kind of where it stops. Mm. And you know, go beyond that, and your only other choices are prepaid mobile data. I know some of the big F&Os are trialing fiber township options, and I welcome it. I think there's a huge market if we think 3.2 million served out of 16. You know, there's another roughly 12 and a bit waiting to be done. And how we see it is if we could do the next million, there would be metro townships that have not got anything but prepaid mobile data right now. That's
right.
What we would call the next million homes. And the principle behind there is no different to what, you know, everyone identified 10 years ago, is that this has to be about density. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the density of people and users in townships, particularly the ones I've described, You naturally, well, we believe that enough 5 rand a day is spent is going to create a yield model that is as bankable, possibly even more bankable than what you would get in Parkhurst, where Boomer started.
Yes. We had Dietlof Maree on the show a couple of weeks ago, where he spoke about this. And in fact, he mentioned Kaimundi as one of the areas where Vumatel is rolling out. Are they working with you guys, or are they running their own project?
Yeah, no, completely separate projects.
Same township.
I've seen on the other side of Kaimundi some pink poles.
Okay.
So yes, I do believe there's a rollout starting there.
Okay.
But I guess it makes sense. It's, you know, Remgro's backyard, and therefore they'll also take a stab there.
I guess so.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about Kaimundi. How big is it? What are you hoping to achieve from this pilot?
Sure. So it's quite a unique township. I don't think, again, every township in South Africa will share the attributes. It's really high density. So I think the total area is 3.2 square kilometers. There are 22,000 homes that we can identify off aerial surveys and so on, of which roughly a quarter are formal. By formal, I'm talking about bricks and mortar, title deeds, and so on.
Yeah.
And the rest, therefore, would be informal shacks, some double-story shacks. There's some really creative. You've got to go and see it to believe it.
Yeah.
And in total, we estimate of the 22,000 houses, that yields a population of about 100,000 people.
Wow. So it's a big opportunity.
It's a huge opportunity. Relatively affluent, because you know, a lot of people don't live in that area. They're simply there to work, and are well employed. I think we'd see a high level of economic activity and income than you'd see in a median South African township. Nevertheless, it's a great testing ground for how we are trying to do this internet in township model.
Right. So do you go to the quarter of the houses that are formal, or are you looking at taking in fiber into shacks as well?
So we do both, and we've got a model that really caters for both. So in the formal homes, we run an aerial fiber from a pole. So so firstly, it's all aerial fiber. We're not trenching down your pavements a la leafy suburb style. Yeah. We're doing aerial fiber because it is just a whole lot less expensive to deploy. We'll run an aerial drop to your formal home, and in there we'll put a router. Mm-hmm. It's our router. It's a public Wi-Fi SSID. And the idea there is, even though it's in your house, and even though you'll benefit from it, and possibly the 8 homes that you've built behind you in your formal home that are typically shacks will get that signal, it's not yours, it's ours. It's the community's. And in a sense, what we're trying to create is a giant hotspot of the whole area, such that there is some mobility. So not when I leave my home, my phone can't reach my router anymore, and therefore I'm not in range. Wherever I am, the SSID will pick me up, and I will have mobility around the community, whether I'm at the spaza shop or at the church or wherever I might be. And that's what we're trying to get right.
So like a kind of a mesh type of network.
Yeah, so I know mesh has got quite a technical definition, but in the looser sense of mesh, yes. It's I think more like a campus hotspot where you're walking around your
so
big
the
office
same
campus.
Same SSID wherever you are.
Correct.
So what is the SSID?
Pay-Gozo.
Pay-Gozo.
Is what it says, which is the name of our ISP that we're using in Kayamundi.
So wherever you go in Kayamundi, you can connect to Pay-Gozo.
Pay-Gozo, that's right. The commercial model on that,
please,
if you're happy for me to tell you.
Yes, of course.
So it's an access or time-based access model, which starts at a denomination of a day. That's R5. That gets one device on the network for 24 hours. How much data you consume, what you do with it, where you roam in the area, none of our business. We just give you that access. Of interest, we launched beginning of September, and we now have enough data to say that generally, people who buy a 24-hour access pass burn about 1.5 gigs of data.
Wow.
So effectively, R5 is equating to 1.5 gigs of data.
Right.
We've seen speeds of 100 megs a second or more. I know it's early days and networks fill up and your curve drops from that, but that is our ambition, is that we keep those speeds at 100 megs a second at R5 a day and do what you like with it. The next option is R30 for a week or R100 for a month. So we're simply trying to pick up on what fiber operators knew 10 years ago, which is if you get your density right, fiber becomes more feasible. Mm. If you get your input costs right, your unit economics are much more attractive than what we've seen so far. That's really the secret sauce, if you want to call it that.
Okay, so you deploy these Wi-Fi hotspots.
Yes.
How do you decide which dwelling gets a hotspot?
Every formal home gets a hotspot.
Every single one?
Yes.
Okay.
So of the 3,000 we've built out to so far, roughly 1,000 meet the formal criteria, and they've all got themselves a router ready. The informal side of the township gets what we call a fiber tower, which is a 9-meter-high gun pole with a giant cambium AP on it, and it beams down into whatever's below it, giving you almost like a center pivot from a, when you fly and you see these big crop circle things.
Yes.
It's basically one of those in an area, and we try and iron out the dead spots between there.
That's
so that everyone in the community has effectively got Wi-Fi.
Right.
One of the things you'll quickly learn in working in Wi-Fi transmission in shacks is that a shack is a giant Faraday cage.
Yes.
So there are challenges in getting the signal in. We've got solutions on that, effectively little antennas with boosters that can help out. But not all shacks are complete Faraday cages. So you are getting some signal, and we are working on how to make it better for everyone there as well.
Okay, and so what sort of density are we looking at in the shackland areas? How many meters between poles?
Roughly 50 meters 50. Between poles.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how many people you're reaching, that is so variable. Because, as I say, some cases you've got large spaces between, and others you've got double-story shacks back to back to each other.
And are each of these poles linked with fiber?
Yes, all the poles. So all the backhauls on fiber.
Via aerial fiber
into the access point. So we're not meshing in the classic sense where we're doing backhaulers on Wi-Fi as well or on radio. We are doing it all on fiber from a backhaul side.
Amazing. Okay. Yeah. And so what has take-up been like so far?
So our model required, I think, 40% of the adults to take it up with one device and spend R70 a month. We've blown all three of those metrics. We've got more people than we thought, because townships are generally denser than you think.
Mm-hmm.
We've got more devices per person than you thought. We've, over the last week, helped set up 4 smart TVs in Kayamundi, now that there's effectively uncapped Wi-Fi, user behavior changes.
Mm-hmm.
And people are spending more than we anticipated. So far, and again, it's early days, that's why we're doing this proof of concept, we believe we're well on the right side of every metric we've set ourselves.
Right. The 1.5 gigabyte per average consumption, is that above what you were expecting?
No, not really. We provision some pretty big backhaul.
Yeah. Because this is uncapped. Yeah. I mean, if there's a sudden surge, if everyone, every shack has now got Netflix, what happens if there's a massive surge?
We just up our backhaul. So our backhaul partner is Liquid in this case. We've been very supportive. of this project. And mm-hmm. I mean, we buy it on commercial terms. We've got a big liquid manhole, meet me manhole cover in Kaimundi,
yeah.
and we'll just turn up more on the backhaul there okay. if we need it.
And this being yeah. South Africa, with crime and theft being rampant, what about protecting your infrastructure that you deploy?
Sure, a great question. We've been at real pains to make sure we've got genuine community involvement. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is we've spent a disproportionate amount of time locating the key movers and shakers in mm-hmm. Kaimundi. They now are working with us. Mm-hmm. That has spawned out employment for the residents of Kaimundi from kind of O&M maintenance all the way through to selling our vouchers. Firstly, we've got, call it a license from the community to operate there. Secondly, we have a value share model with the community. We're not, you know, waving our way leave and saying we've got a right to put up a pole and that's it. We are working with the community to deploy, to train, to teach, and we believe that once we've got it, the network live, and we effectively move out of build mode to maintenance mode, the community stands to gain as well from the various kind of streams that flow from there.
Right.
Again, resetting, maintenance, and so on. We had one interesting incident where a pole disappeared on a Friday night, and very early on Saturday.
An entire pole?
A gun pole, yeah. Okay. It was just, you know, lying in the yard getting ready to be built.
Okay.
And it got returned the next day with an apology because the community stepped in to say, hang on, not right. cool.
Yeah.
I think our surprise from the community has been just how welcoming they've been for this project. And when people got over the fact they thought it was a scam, you can't give me internet for $5,000 a day and not have a catch there, when that's, you know, being seen, I think is a real sense, well, this is going to be life-changing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, just some more stats. We've now got over 10,000 unique registered users on the platform now, and just for the 3,000 homes we've covered. So we haven't completed
the project. And over what period of time are we talking here?
2 months.
Okay.
Yeah, 2.5 months, beginning of September to date.
Right. So that's a good percentage of the total population.
Good percentage. We pleased. As I say, yeah. again, we've been surprised at how well this has been received.
Yeah, yeah. It must take a lot of time though to engage with community leaders and to identify who the leaders are in the area and get that community buy-in. Is that something you're going to have to do in every township and every area that you roll out? And is that going to slow down your deployment?
I think it's an absolute prerequisite for success.
Okay.
And if it slows down deployment, we'd rather work in those areas where there are community structures that are stable and welcoming than think it's about a land grab and putting capital in the ground and then wondering why those projects fail.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it is time consuming, but it's also absolute prerequisite and I guess to some degree a potential comparative advantage yeah. for what we're trying to do.
Yeah. I know a big challenge facing fiber operators and all businesses around South Africa, these so-called business forums, these criminal groups that want to extract their pound of flesh from deployments. Have you seen any of that in Kaimundi?
Not in Kaimundi. I mean, we're very aware of what's of those, as well as the construction mafias that
yes.
kind of support them and so on. Again, if we get into an area and it becomes apparent that that's how the rules are going to be, or that's what the rules are there, we'll rather walk away.
You'll walk away?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just not going to be feasible for our model or what we're trying to do in those communities.
Yeah. So tell us about your partners, your PayGozo. Who are they? They're the ISP, but are right. they associated with this as well?
Very much so. So mm-hmm. so quick org chart.
Sure.
There's iCizwe. iCizwe is the controlling shareholder of both PayGozo and VulaCoin.
Ah.
So iCizwe is really just, I mean, it shouldn't be a customer-facing brand at all. I know it's been spun up in the press a bit, but really the two go-to-market brands are PayGozo, that was started by Rich Hen and his team, deep fiber deployment experience, if you look at who's in there. They are both the ISP and the fiber network operator for now. I mean, in time, we're still working out whether you can, you know, be both or be one or the other, but for now, to prove our point, they're both the F&O and the ISP. And then VulaCoin is effectively a payment wallet. It's okay. got some quite sexy tech behind it. It's got, you know, blockchain and things like that, but that's really not what its selling point is. The selling point is it's there to solve for microtransactions that are quite expensive. Just give you an example. If you were to buy R5 vouchers every time you needed internet on your kind of normal bank rails, let's say you've got a Capitec card, not picking on Capitec, any bank would be the same.
Sure.
You're going to pay roughly $250 through the value chain just to have that R5 put in. I mean, that's 50% of face value. That's quite a high commission effectively on that transaction.
Yeah.
So what Bullocoin is there to solve is once the value is in the wallet, and you can put value in three ways. Again, you can use a debit or credit card, you can use a voucher like Flash, or we've got resellers in the community who you give them a 5 rand coin, they will flick 5 rand into your PayGozo account.
Right.
Once the value is in there, every transaction after that carries no transaction cost from our side. We're not clipping the ticket again. So we're trying to solve for micropayments in there, and that seems to be working so far. I mean, not that there's any shortage of wallets in South Africa, surprisingly, but this is one in particular that seems to have a good application and has been well received by the community.
So is Bullocoin itself a cryptocurrency?
No. It's a stable coin if you want to get into to the details. So it's pegged to value. It's a one-to-one value to the rand. But truly, that's not what you're trying to do, is spin up a crypto on the side.
Okay.
It's really just we're using the benefits of blockchain, the openness and the transparency to run a wallet, because ultimately the scale economies on that are far less, mm-hmm. or far higher than your typical banking structures.
Right.
That's really why we've chosen that.
Fascinating. Yeah. Is that a bit of an indictment, do you think, on the financial services industry in South Africa?
I think it's fair to say the financial services, whether the payment associations or the card associations or the banks, would all agree that there's a problem when it comes to micropayments.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got big payments, it's great. There's security. You're taking cash out the system. But if you and I want to spend 5 rand or less on something, that's kind of where the payment side in the traditional sense falls a bit short.
Right. Okay. Now, you mentioned that the cost of aerial fiber versus trenched fiber in the suburbs has traditionally been trenched.
Yes.
How much cheaper is it?
So, happy to disclose our costing. We are in our cost per house in the traditional bricks and mortar sense, so the more formal houses, is 2,500 rand. That's the aerial fiber, that's the engineering behind there, and that's the router. I led to believe that in some of the leafy suburbs, it can be much, much higher than that, in the double digits even.
Yeah.
So it is a lot less expensive to put it down in from an aerial perspective.
Right. Okay. And how does it work? Just literally poles with fiber rings and then you just pull it down from there into the homes.
That's it. I mean, no secret sauce there. It's what you'd expect in any other kind of fiber build-out, just using poles overhead.
Okay.
I believe it's called a block build model.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And the type of fiber, I mean, is it? What can you do with this fiber? Are there any limitations to it compared to what you'd get, the fiber you'd get in a traditional residential home?
It's the same standard
stuff.
Yeah, yeah. There's nothing different about how we deploy or what we deploy from a fiber side. In fact, we actually have invested in quite expensive kits. Our routers are Nokia, for example.
Right.
And we're surprised by how that brand is still well known in the community. I think Nokia did such a good branding job on their phones all those years ago.
Exactly.
that there's a sense of, oh wow, you're putting a Nokia in my house. That's amazing. So kudos to Nokia for their brand.
Yeah, for sure. Amazing. So what's next? What's after Kaya Mundi? Once you've proven the model, what do you do after that?
So we again acknowledge we're in a giant laboratory experiment at the moment. We want to close out the rest of Kaya Mundi by the end of Q1 next year. So call it end of March 23. We would then want to deploy to two other adjacent townships, Mfuleni and Nomzamo, mm-hmm. Somerset West and Gordons Bay, which is almost contiguous with Kaya Mundi if you just think of the geography of of that part of the Western Cape. That in total would take us to 110,000 homes. In those three townships. What we want to use next year for is to, I guess, proof test our idea that this can be done at scale with smart civil engineers who've got real kind of spatial planning analysis and the ability to build out big civil projects. So I think we're quite used to big civil projects being electricity or power or sewerage, but that kind of thinking is seemingly a bit short on the telco side. We're trying to translate that kind of big scale capital deployment into a telco type model. And once we've done that and we've hopefully still meet all our key metrics at the end of next year, we believe we've got a potential business here which we would then look to other parts of Metro South Africa to go and duplicate. And possibly even beyond. I mean, it's not unique in South Africa that there's a big problem to get equitable internet access to poorer communities.
Now, you may soon be competing with the likes of Vumatel, which is backed by giants like soon to be Vodacom, Remgro. Sure. This is a scale game. What's your funding behind? What funding model behind this?
Sure.
You're going to need some quite deep pockets, I imagine, if you want to take on the big guys.
Quite right. Mm. So I mean, building telco infrastructure is eye-wateringly expensive. It's one giant, you know, capex grind, if you want to call it that. The good news is that the kind of postpaid fiber network success over the last 8 to 10 years has certainly caught the attention of the big banks and big investors. So we've been pleasantly surprised at how much capital there seems to be if you can prove a model, from big project finance with South African banks on big commercial terms to DFIs and you know, foreign funding institutions. If you can show a decent business case, there's no shortage of capital.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do. So by taking our time to spin this up and make sure we've got the model right, we do believe that the capital will follow from there.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Have you had conversations at this stage with any of the banks or
we have.
Funders?
Yeah, we
are
have.
Are they showing interest?
Deep interest. Deep interest. We really are, you know, quite far down the road on some of those conversations already.
Yeah. What about load shedding? How does that impact you?
So it certainly has a huge impact. In fact, you can see our usage stats climbing nicely during the day, and then you just see an absolute kind of chasm for 2 hours. The interesting thing is the floor at the bottom of that chasm is getting slightly higher each time.
Okay.
And what that says is that people are putting devices in their homes for backup. So our Nokia CPE we use, if you plug a normal cell phone backup power bank in there, the thing can carry on.
Okay.
So people have worked that out. Interestingly, on the kind of less formal side, the big Wi-Fi access points I was talking about earlier, we actually can keep those up during load shedding. We've got a really interesting bit of technology that allows us to, from our kind of central node in Kaimandi, power those so that during load shedding, you actually still have access to the internet. We keep the internet up and we keep the signal beaming down.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bit of kind of social justice there when in the, you know, suburbs that you can see in Stellenbosch that pay a lot more for the internet, they're hard down and our community is still up even during load shedding. But to the point of your question, load shedding has a massive impact on how people consume the internet.
Is it much easier to keep a fiber network up during load shedding than it is a cellular base station? Because I notice in my area, my fiber connection stays up throughout load shedding when there's a power. In fact, if the power goes off for a day, the fiber stays up.
Yeah.
But the local cell phone tower falls over.
Yeah. Look, I mean, probably a bit beyond my ability to give you a good technical answer, but anecdotally, I've seen the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think some of the networks, the mobile networks, are now on record saying they've had all their batteries stolen and their generators and their diesel.
Yeah.
So from now on, if the lights are out, the tower's down and don't ask any more questions. Whereas the fiber networks do seem to have a way of keeping it up. And certainly the network we've built in Kaimandi, we've built in from the start a battery backup, knowing how impactful load shedding can be in that community.
So before I let you go, Steve, this really is quite an exciting development. Is South Africa pioneering this? I know that South Africa was a pioneer in prepaid cellular, and that's actually what led to the explosion of cellular use across the country and then ultimately around the world. Are we in South Africa actually starting to pioneer this concept of cheap prepaid fiber? And if it works here, do you think this is going to become the model across the developing world?
So there definitely are examples in other parts of the world. I think of Kenya. I think of a company called POA and Mwingu separately.
Okay.
They've got similar ideas. But I do think we're onto something here. And if I just look at the interest shown by, call it the international vendor and finance community for this particular project, there does seem to be some sense of us plowing a new furrow, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can execute on our lofty ambitions and we can export this model. That would be our intention.
Okay. Steve Briggs is CEO of Isizwe. Good luck to you and your team. Fascinating project. And thanks for joining us in the studio at Tech Central.
Thank you very much, Duncan.
Thanks, Steve.